Chancellor, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of South Australia, Chief Judge of the District Court of South Australia, distinguished guests, special guests, Mr. Len Murray, ladies and gentlemen. I first wish to acknowledge the Kaurna people, the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains, and the land on which the University of Adelaide's campuses at North Terrace, Waite and Roseworthy are built. The University of Adelaide recognises their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationship with the land and pays respect to the elders past and present. My name is Matt Murphy, and it is my privilege as President of the John Bray Law Alumni Network, an alumni group of the university, to welcome you to the John Bray Oration. The names of the network and of the oration commemorate Dr. John Bray, Chief Justice of South Australia from 1967 to 1978, and Chancellor of the University from 1968 to 1983. Dr. Bray is remembered as perhaps South Australia's greatest jurist. As a judge, his formidable legal knowledge, skills and techniques worked hand in hand with a profound belief in the importance and freedom of the individual. In naming the network and the oration after Dr. Bray, the graduates of the law school bore these qualities in mind as they were most respected and to which they most aspired. The oration represents the network's contribution to bringing important legal topics and socially related issues to its members and to the wider community of South Australia. This oration was only possible due to the generous financial support of the Howard Zelling Lecture Trust, and we are grateful for their contribution. Without doubt, a topic most concerning to the whole community at the present time is the delay in matters coming on for trial. This is at its most pressing in the case of criminal trials, where delays cause distress and trauma to victims and witnesses, and accused persons later found to be innocent may have been held in custody for long periods. Dr. Bray was very conscious of the need for speedy justice, he having observed in a civil case, Balfour and Clark v. Hollandia, the following: I cannot part with the appeal without expressing my gratification that an action commenced on the 7th of June 1977 was brought to trial in September 1977 and disposed of by order of the learned judge on the 20th of October 1977. This evening's oration will be presented by Mr. Len Murray, a retired pleader in Scotland. For those of you who do not know, Scots law has, to my knowledge, the strictest legal time limits for court hearings in the world. No doubt this topic, and perhaps many others, Mr. Murray will speak on this evening. I now call upon His Honour the Chief Justice to formally introduce Mr. Murray.
Mr. Len Murray is a retired pleader, in our terms a solicitor of the Supreme Court of Scotland, and he has been involved in some of the most prominent legal cases in Scotland. He studied law and modern languages and history at Glasgow University, qualifying later as a solicitor, and he practiced as a solicitor until his retirement in 2003. He has been described in Scotland as the most respected solicitor of his generation, as one of the most acclaimed Scottish lawyers of his time. During his lengthy career, he tutored at Glasgow and Strathclyde universities, lectured at the Police College for 16 years and served on the Central Committee of the Law Society of Scotland for 8 years before going on to be the Vice Chairman for another 2 years. He served as a temporary sheriff, that is, the equivalent of district court judge, and as a part-time chair of numerous employment, medical appeals and social security appeals tribunals. He worked on many famous cases and for many household names, including Paul McCartney, Bill Connolly and David Soule. He has an extensive experience in criminal law matters. Mr. Murray is regarded as the world's foremost speaker on the Scottish national poet Robert Burns and his immortal memory. has spoken at some 400 Burns suppers over five continents and is the Dean of the Guild of Robert Burns Speakers. Robert Burns has had a long-lasting and international influence despite living only for 37 years in the 18th century. His literary influence extends to just last year's Nobel laureate in literature, Bob Dylan, who says that The Red, Red Rose is the longest and most lasting influence on his literary career. Robert Burns was also an early champion of the liberal democratic tradition, which marks the democracies of the developed world to this day. So the combination of Scottish lawyer and Robert Burns' disciple makes Mr. Murray a very apposite choice for the 2017 John Bray Oration. The rule of law and the democratic principle are complementary principles. The existence of the rule of law under a monarchy or plutocracy or aristocracy is tenuous at best, and majority rule without the rule of law, the dictatorship of the majority, if you like, threatens individual liberty and human dignity. The spread of totalitarianism around the world in our age, in our day, threatens that liberal democratic legacy of people like Robert Burns. In many ways, Europe, with its adoption and implementation of the European Convention on Human Rights by the Council of Europe in 1953 and by the European Union since then, makes Europe a bastion of that liberal democratic tradition. And as we well know, Scotland's, whose laws are a fusion of both Anglo-Saxon common law and civil law, continental civil law, may well be at the centre of the centrifugal forces, or find itself at the centre of the centrifugal forces which swirl around Europe and may have to make difficult choices. So in both that context and in the more practical context to which Matt referred of the procedural, criminal procedural laws in Scotland, Mr. Murray's oration today is of great interest. As you probably know, he will speak on some of the unique features of the Scottish legal system, including the extraordinarily strict time limits which it applies in its criminal procedure. I ask you to welcome Mr. Len Murray.
Before I begin, may I ask, can you hear me at the back? You should be able to, because you know it is said that when I ask the question of a witness in Court 1, I usually got an answer from Courts 2, 3, 4 and 5 at the same time. And Chief Justice, your very flattering introduction came as considerable pleasure. I enjoyed listening to what I had done. And as a matter of fact, I thought I could listen to this all night. And for a few minutes, I feared that I might have to. But I feel terribly humbled at being asked to join that list of very distinguished speakers who have given this oration. And I'm delighted to be back in Adelaide, a city that I fell in love with when I first came here 5 years ago. And that love affair, I may tell you, has lasted ever since. But Chancellor, Chief Justice, Chief Judge, Your Honours, distinguished guests, and just as importantly, pipers, thank you very much indeed for paying me the honour of asking me to come here. Here in this building, incidentally, dedicated to another Scot, Thomas Elder, came from Kirkcuddy in the east of Scotland And he was one of four brothers who all emigrated to Australia, and all of whom appear to have contributed to the common weal of the Commonwealth. Let me speak to you, first of all, if I may, about the constitutional position of Scotland. It is part of the United Kingdom, and it covers the northern third of the island of Great Britain. It has a population of about 5.3 million, and it shares a border with England to the south, and otherwise its borders are maritime. It's perhaps not generally appreciated that Scotland consists, it includes not just the mainland, but more than 790 islands, including the northern islands of the Orkneys and the Shetlands and the Hebrides to the northwest of the mainland. The Kingdom of Scotland emerged as an independent sovereign state in the early Middle Ages, and it continued to exist as a sovereign state until 1707. And by inheritance in 1603, James VI of Scotland became James I of England, and the crowns of Scotland and England were united. It was in 1707 a political union took place, and the Act and Treaty of Union came into force on the 1st of May of that year, and that created the new Kingdom of Great Britain. The Union also created a new Parliament of Great Britain, which succeeded both the Parliaments of Scotland and the Parliament of England. I say it was a union of the Parliaments, but that's an exaggeration. In fact, it was an absorption, and within a matter of months, the customs and the ways of the old Scots Parliament had disappeared, and we found ourselves subject to the rules, the customs, the habits of the English Parliament, the pre-1707 English Parliament. In 1801, Britain itself entered into a political union with the Kingdom of Ireland, and thus creating the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. And since the creation of what was then called the Irish Free State and now the Republic of Ireland in 1922, the United Kingdom is comprised of Great Britain and six of the northern counties of Ireland. And it's perhaps not generally appreciated that until the union of the crowns and thereafter the parliaments, we had nothing in common with our neighbours to the south. And indeed, since the Battle of Echtensmere in 685 AD, we had constantly been at war with the English. And sometimes I think not a great deal has changed since then. We had our own monarchy, we had our own parliament, we had our own system of law, our own kirk, our own culture, our own literature, our own educational system. And that system was very important because Scotland was the first country in the universe to introduce compulsory education. And the benefit of that would be shown in the succeeding centuries. At least we kept our own system of law, and it's quite distinct from that which obtains in the remaining parts of Great Britain. That union, incidentally, is in theory a union of equal partners, but there are many in Scotland today who maintain that that is clearly not the case. When you have one partner 11 times bigger than another, it is perhaps not unnatural that the smaller one suffers. And during the age of the great Scottish Enlightenment, from the middle of the 18th century to the early 19th century, Scotland gave to the world more men of letters and more men of learning than did any other nation on God's earth. And we were the most literate nation in the world. Winston Churchill, arguably the greatest Englishman who ever lived, he said in 1922 that only the ancient Greeks have contributed more to civilization than have the Scots. And when you consider what the Scots have given civilization since 1922, for example, the discovery of penicillin which it said has cured more people than have been killed in all the wars since. When you consider what Scotland has given the world, it might very well be that if Winston Churchill were alive today and were to repeat what he said, he wouldn't include that qualification. Incidentally, the union of the parliaments in 1707 took place in the teeth of bitter opposition in Scotland. There was rioting in every major city and town throughout the country. Andrew Fletcher of Saltoun, a towering figure in the then Scottish political scene, said that Scotland had been sold by what he called a parcel of rogues. And it was a theme that Robert Burns would subsequently take up in one of his better known poems. The Kirk, the Church of Scotland, the National Church of Scotland, declared a day of national mourning for what it called the humiliation of Scotland by that union. I think it's accepted that that union was brought about by bribery and corruption. Fewer than 1 in 600 had the vote, so it wasn't terribly difficult to win over the electorate, especially with promises of dukedoms and other such rewards. It's interesting to observe also that only 4 years after the passing of the coming into being of the Act and Treaty of Union, only 4 years later, a motion to dissolve the Union was defeated by only 4 votes. A fact which shows just how unpopular the Union was at the time. Following a referendum in 1997, a Scottish Parliament was re-established in the form of a devolved unicameral legislature comprising 129 members, having authority over many areas of domestic policy. The Scottish National Party, the SNP, which supports Scottish independence, won an overall majority in the Scottish Parliament in 2008 and legislated for an independence referendum, which was held on the 18th of September 2014. A majority of 55% to 45% voted to remain in the United Kingdom on an 85% voter turnout. The figure was surprising because the opinion polls, some of them had forecast victory for a vote for independence. At best, they showed almost neck and neck. The following year, in the UK general election, the Conservative Party won an overall majority and legislated for a referendum on the UK's membership of the European Union. And that is something which vitally affects the law of Scotland. That referendum was held on the 23rd of June 2016, and within Scotland. Scotland voted 62% to 38% to remain in Europe. And they rejected withdrawal from the EU on a 67% voter turnout. England, perhaps much more xenophobic than Scotland, voted to leave the EU by 53 to 47%. The overall picture was that on an overall turnout of 36%, the UK voted to pull out. 64% of those eligible to vote in the United Kingdom did not vote to leave the EU. And it's oddly enough a major alteration in the constitution of a company requires a vote of 75% of its shareholders. Yet we have a prime minister who regards a vote of 36% as being a sufficient mandate for her to lead what is clearly known as a hard Brexit after 45 years of membership. Scotland is represented in the UK Parliament in Westminster by 59 MPs. Of those 59, 56 belong to the Scottish National Party. There is one Conservative, one Liberal Democrat, one Labour. It perhaps indicates the feeling of the majority of the electorate of Scotland. In the European Parliament, there are six Scottish MEPs, three of whom are from the Scottish National Party, and one each from Labour UKIP. That's the xenophobes from England, United Kingdom Independence Party, and one Labour. A general election is about to take place in the UK on the 8th of June, and we shall see what happens thereafter. But it is expected that we will have another Conservative government in Westminster. A number of matters have been devolved to Holyrood, the Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh, by successive Scotland Acts. Agriculture, forestry, fisheries, education, environment, health, social services, housing, law and order, local government, sport and the arts, tourism and so on. Reserved matters include benefits and social security, immigration, defence, foreign policy, employment law, broadcasting, trade and industry, and so on. Scotland at the moment is part of the European Union, but it is the UK which is the member state, though it looks as though that membership is coming to an end. We have adopted the European Convention on Human Rights and imported it into our law. Consequently, we are subject to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice on matters of European law and to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights on questions of breach of those rights. And those rights are spelt out in the Convention, but they include such obvious ones as the right to life, prohibition of torture, of slavery, the right to a fair trial, to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, to respect for private and family life, and various others, including a prohibition of capital punishment. Historically, we in Scotland have always been European in our outlook, and from the 13th until the 17th century, the old alliance was in place, and Scotland and France were bound by successive treaties for mutual defence against England. Our allies were not across the border, but they were across the English Channel. The crowns of Scotland and France were briefly united. Mary, Queen of Scots, of whom no doubt many of you have heard, was briefly also Queen of France. The children of the well-to-do in Scotland didn't go to Eton or Harrow or Oxbridge. They went to Leiden or Utrecht, Paris or even Rome. England, on the other hand, was pretty constantly at war in Europe, so there have always been closer ties between Scotland and Europe. And let me, if I may, say something of our judicial system. Scotland's criminal judicial system is renowned for its independence and its accessibility. There are four levels of court in the Scottish criminal justice system. The High Court of Justiciary, our Supreme Criminal Court. Its seat is Edinburgh, in Scotland's capital, but it sits on circuit in all the major cities and towns of Scotland. It is comprised of 36 judges. We call them Senators of the College of Justice, and they are given the courtesy title of Lord or Lady whatever. And ladies, in case you wonder, the ladies of Scotland have got more than their fair share of membership of the College of Justice. I remember when I first qualified, and I'm not going to disclose how many centuries ago that was, when I first qualified, there was no female High Court judge, and there was only one female sheriff. Things have changed. When I entered the Faculty of Law at Glasgow University, there were 76 in my year. Three were ladies. Things have changed since then. And if there were 76 entering today, it would be 40 female and 36 male. And I understand that that is pretty generally the case, other than in the Scottish universities. Our High Court has exclusive jurisdiction over certain crimes like murder, rape, or culpable homicide. And you use, I think, the term, as do the English, manslaughter. It's culpable homicide in Scotland. Armed robbery and drug trafficking are generally reserved also for the High Court, and serious sexual offences involving children now go to the High Court. And cases are presided over a judge, a single judge, and a jury of 15. 15. And no one, so far as I have been able to ascertain, not even my good friend, a former lecturer in the history of Scots law at Glasgow University, no one has been able to tell me why we prefer juries of 15. But certainly by the 18th century, it was established that we would have 15 on our juries. Majority verdicts have always been competent, but there must always be 8 of the jury in favor of a verdict of guilty. That may seem pretty obvious to most of us, but some years ago, in the sheriff court, there was a case where 6 were in favor of guilty, 5 in favor of not guilty, and 4 in favor of that peculiarly and exclusively Scottish verdict of not proven. And on the basis that there were 6 guilty, the jury returned a majority verdict of guilty. Fortunately, that came to light. Though since our Contempt of Court Act of 1981, when you may not ask a jury any questions, that it wouldn't have come to light. Before I speak about not proven, it's often argued that a simple majority should not be enough. If, for example, a jury returns a verdict of guilty by a majority of 8-7, can it reasonably be said that the guilt of the accused has been proved beyond reasonable doubt? The Scottish Government has a consultation paper out at the moment on the subject of the Scottish jury in criminal trials, and it will be interesting to see what it brings. The move seems to be for at least 10 before a verdict of guilty is returned. And any crime committed in any part of Scotland may be tried by the High Court, though as a matter of convenience to witnesses, the trial generally takes place in the town nearest where the crime had been committed. Although just the month before last, a rather celebrated Glasgow case was heard in Aberdeen, 150 miles away. We have no opening address in a criminal case. That opening address is common in Anglo-Saxon traditions, but we go straight to the evidence. The presiding judge usually tells the jury at the beginning of the trial something of the procedure that will be followed, but of course nothing of the evidence. And nor does a person have a right to go to trial by jury. And why should they? Our High Court also has appellate functions, and in the exercise of its appellate functions, 3 judges are required. And the more difficult appeals, and there have been many in recent years, particularly on European matters, there is no limit to the number of judges who may sit. And below the High Court, we have the Sheriff Court. The country is divided into 5 sheriffdoms, each of which is presided over by a sheriff principal, and a total of 49 sheriff court districts. And within each sheriffdom, there are 3 levels of criminal court. There is the sheriff and jury, where cases are presided over by a sheriff and tried by a jury, again, of 15 men and women. And a sheriff in these circumstances can impose a custodial sentence of up to 5 years. At the moment, preliminary procedure in our sheriff and jury court is rather different from that in the High Court. But as from the 27th of this month, May, the procedure adopted by both the High Court and sheriff and jury will be identical. A sheriff may also sit on his own in cases that are of lesser importance. And indeed, he can impose a custodial sentence of up to a year and a fine of up to £10,000. And bringing up the rear are our Justice of the Peace Courts. A layperson is a justice. He is guided by a legally qualified assessor. They deal with the more minor crimes. A justice is appointed by the Scottish Government on the recommendation of the local authority. And any appeal from the Sheriff Summary or the Justice of the Peace Court goes to the Sheriff Appeal Court, which consists of 3 sheriffs sitting together. Our system of prosecution: Crown Office and Procurator, Fiscal Service is Scotland's prosecution service, and it is they who receive police reports and decide what action, if any, to take. They also investigate sudden deaths, all deaths in custody, whether in police custody or in prison, and they investigate allegations of criminal conduct on the part of police officers. And public interest is a major factor, or at least it should be a major factor, in any decision taken by Crown Office. At its head is the Lord Advocate, and he is the chief legal officer of the Scottish Government and the Crown in Scotland for both civil and criminal matters that fall within the devolved powers of the Scottish Parliament. He is the Chief Public Prosecutor for Scotland, and all prosecutions on indictment, whether in the High Court or in the Sheriff and Jury Court, are brought in his name. The Office of Advocate is rather ancient, and it can be traced back to 1483. The appointment is a governmental appointment. And in the old days when the government changed, so did the Lord Advocate. So he always had the same political hue as the government of the day. That has come to an end, fortunately. And from 1707 until 1998, the Lord Advocate was the chief legal advisor of the British government and the Crown for Scotland. The Scotland Act of 1988, which devolved most domestic affairs to the Scottish Parliament, changed that. And the UK government are now advised in Scots law by the Advocate General for Scotland. And the office holder is one of the great officers of state for Scotland. Delay. A subject of considerable interest in many jurisdictions. And it was one which bothered us considerably. Do you know, ever since the Criminal Procedure Act of 1701, 216 years ago, there has always been provision in Scots law to ensure that persons are not kept in custody awaiting trial for a unduly length of time. It was William Penn who founded Pennsylvania and Philadelphia and Delaware, and it was he who first coined the phrase justice delayed is justice denied. And it's something that I think has always been adopted in Scotland. Our system, until quite recently, for dealing with serious crime, was based upon Victorian statutes, which of course proved to be quite inconvenient so far as modern society is concerned. But in the past 20 years or so, our criminal procedure has been updated. I think that probably the steps that have been taken by successive governments have been aimed at eradicating those matters that led to delay and inconvenience in the prosecution of crime. And not only that, of course, if a person is innocent, it is only right that that innocence should be judicially determined just as soon as is humanly practical. And before the modern reforms were introduced, when an indictment was served on an accused person, whether in the Sheriff Court or the High Court, he was cited to a pleading diet where he was called upon to plead. And that was a mere formality, because if he were to plead not guilty, the case is remitted to the trial diet in 10 days' time. And if he pled guilty, it may or may not be disposed of that day, but he was almost certainly remanded in custody while inquiry is made into the circumstances. But of course, these sittings of the courts, they were all due to begin on the same Monday. And so we had this nonsense of perhaps 24 indictments calling on a Thursday at a pleading diet. And if you imagine that 21 of them pled not guilty, then all 21 were continued to a trial diet a week on Monday. And so a week on Monday, not only did 21 accused people appear, but the witnesses for these 21 trials appeared, and what's much more important, the unempaneled jurors will also appear. And when you consider that we have juries of 15 people, and in my early days, you had 5 peremptory objections to a juror. In other words, he needn't come. You didn't need to give a reason. You could say that 5 times. You can imagine the chaos that used to reign on a Monday morning. And for God knows how many years that system obtained. And then it suddenly occurred to somebody or other, hey, maybe there's a better way of doing things. So we began to look. And there were commissions presided over, one by a sheriff principal and the other by a high court judge. And we now have our system. And all of what we used to have is gone. And there are time limits. If a person is brought before the court with a serious charge and is remanded in custody, then he must be brought to his preliminary hearing within a period of 80 days of his committal. And the preliminary hearing is an entirely new concept in Scotland. And it's one that I commend to any system which has the accusatorial method of criminal investigation. And our judges customarily simply sit there and listen to the evidence and decide. They may have a jury, they may not. But theirs is not an inquisitorial rule, generally. Well, at a preliminary hearing, by a preliminary hearing, each side must have exchanged information. The accused must state his position in regard to the charge levelled against him. And the old concept of the inalienable right of silence has gone. And let me take it slightly out of the order I intended. But our then Lord Justice General, in considering this question, you see, one accused said, no, I'm not telling you what I'm going to say. Because telling you is a breach of my human rights under the ECHR, under Section 6 of the European Convention, I'm entitled to keep my silence, so I'm not telling you. Well, he didn't get away with it. The matter came before the High Court, and our Lord Justice General, who was then Brian Gill, he said, I consider that the right to silence is not absolute. The starting point is simple. Justice must be done. And you might think, why didn't somebody think about that ages ago? That justice must be done. Is that not what our courts are intended to be all about? And he says there are other legitimate interests. The general public interest in the efficient and expeditious conduct of prosecutions. And in the maintenance of public confidence in the system of criminal justice. There is the legitimate public interest in the avoidance of needless expense to the court administration and to the Scottish Legal Aid Board. And the Scottish Legal Aid Board, it's the first time they got a mention. And the avoidance of, maybe it's as well that they did get a mention because it's the taxpayer who funds them. And those of us who pay income tax have got some saying, or like to think we should have some saying, in where our money goes. And the avoidance of dislocation of the court timetable. There are also the legitimate interests of jurors in being spared the ordeal of a trial that is needlessly prolonged. But you see, the, if you like, the crux of it, the essence of it, is the preliminary hearing. For the judge takes on a totally different role. He takes on the kind of role that is quite common, I understand, in the Napoleonic system. Interesting, those countries in Europe that Napoleon conquered, and there were quite a few of them, by and large, that kicked off the Napoleonic system, where you have an inquisitorial judge who asks a lot of questions. Now, at that preliminary hearing, so much takes place. When the preliminary hearing is fixed, a period of half an hour is allocated for each one. I have with me, and you're welcome to it, to see some of the things that a preliminary hearing covers. A vast number of questions is asked of each party. There is a written record of proceedings. There are, I think it's something like 51 separate questions are asked. The written record has to be completed by both the prosecutor and defender. The preliminary hearings, here's what I'm after. There are 50 odd questions asked in 51 questions asked in an eight page document. But in addition, there must be completed a written record of what is going on, that question after question is asked. And things like admissibility of evidence, that's determined not at the trial. You see, at the trial, imagine you've got a jury of 15 folk, and a piece of evidence is led, and counsel for one side or other stands up and says, "My Lord, with great respect, I'm taking exception to this line of questioning." "Oh, really, Mr. Murray? Right. Ladies and gentlemen, will you retire, please?" "All right." So they get up and away they go, while this question of law is argued in their absence. And they may be out sitting in their jury room, and there is nothing quite as bleak as a jury room in my experience. Sitting there wondering what on earth is going on. Are they carving this thing up between themselves? And so His Lordship rules that that line is admissible, so back they come. And 5 minutes later, "I'm sorry, but I'm taking objection. Ladies and gentlemen, do you mind?" "Oh, not again." And away they go. Well, now, you see, the issue is focused before the trial takes place. And it's focused at that preliminary hearing. And productions which are going to be founded upon at the trial, they are all there, and they are lodged in time for the preliminary hearing. So if there is any issue on any of those documents, then the preliminary hearing is the time and the place to determine it. And more, a judge doesn't automatically fix a date for trial. Statutorily, he may not fix a trial diet unless and until he is reasonably satisfied that the trial will proceed on that day. So you've got to go into the PH knowing how available are your witnesses. And it means that both prosecutor and defense has checked up to make sure that everybody's okay for the 19th of whatever. And then, and only then, is the trial diet fixed. The result is that trials in Scotland are totally different now from what they used to be. You get nosy Parker judges who, if they do their job correctly, ensure that at the trial diet, the issue is firmly focused upon the facts which are there. And it's a system I commend. It's working. It's working well. And the more used the profession becomes to it, the more efficiently it will run. I have had the opportunity of chatting at some length ever since I heard that I was being honoured by being invited. Thanks to you, Peter, invited to deliver this oration. I've taken the opportunity of speaking to as many people on both sides of the bar as I could to find out the reaction to it all. There is still in summary procedure. It's not called a preliminary hearing, it's called an intermediate diet. And it's perhaps not quite as formalized as the preliminary hearing, but the intermediate diet does assist in ironing out matters which otherwise would have come out in the trial, which would have held things up in the trial. Now, Matt, you must guide me. My watch is still on UK time because I've got 7 minutes. Okay. 7 rapid minutes. Not proven. Not proven. Now, we have a verdict, as I say, a verdict of not proven. And the reason is historical. Because in the old days, a Scottish jury was not invited to say whether a person is guilty or not guilty. But various facts and material facts which are alleged in the indictment, each of those was put to the jury individually. Like, did he assault that man on that date? Yes. And did he take a bit of wood and hit him over the head? And did the man die? And all of these separate facts are put. And the jury had to say whether each individual fact was proven or was it not proven. And then it was in 1728, that this brave advocate decided this wasn't good enough. And so convinced was he in his client's innocence. A thing, incidentally, I urge advocates to have no view on. But so convinced was he of his client's innocence that he insisted to the jury that they should return a verdict of not guilty. And no Scottish jury had ever heard of a verdict of not guilty before that. So they did. And that encouraged others, would you believe, to invite juries to return verdicts of not guilty. And so the habit began. It was a bad habit. It's one that we inherited from those people on the other side of Hadrian's Wall. You know, they always had verdicts of guilty or not guilty, but we didn't. Is that fact proven? Is this fact proven? And so on and so forth. Now, interestingly enough, I mentioned the jury of 15. There is a consultation paper out from the Scottish government on the whole question of a criminal procedure, including the not proven verdict. Now, we and we alone have the verdict. Personally, I regard it as being absolutely mad. There is a presumption that a person charged with a criminal offence, there is a presumption that he is innocent. And that presumption obtains until proof comes, proof beyond reasonable doubt of his guilt. And if there is not proof beyond reasonable doubt, then, of course, the presumption kicks in, and he is therefore not guilty. There is no room for not proven. And, do you know, there is a story told that goes way back to the First World War, where the 51st Highland Division, the Glasgow Division of the HLI, the Highland Light Infantry, were going past the Lord Provost, of Glasgow. In other jurisdictions, they speak of the Lord Mayor, but we have a Lord Provost. And the Lord Provost was taking the salute. And all of these guys in the 51st Division were beautifully in step but one. And he was called Jock. And Jock's wife was heard to exclaim, "The row a step but your Jock." And so I suppose one could say that everybody else is out of step except your joke, so far as the not proven verdict is concerned. But the chances are, I would imagine, it will appear. A few months ago, I had a radio argument I was taking the view that the verdict has to be abolished. We look stupid with it. And the Justice Secretary for Scotland was arguing, oh, well, I think I might be sympathetic, but I've got to do some research into it. And I challenged him to tell the waiting public in Scotland what research he could do into it. And he wasn't able to tell. So who knows? But ladies and gentlemen, if there is any any question that arises, provided it's an easy question, I'll try and answer it.
We have a short amount of time for questions from the floor.
Comments on the relationship between the High Court and the Scottish system and the new Supreme Court of the United Kingdom.
Ah, now that's a very interesting question, because the Supreme Civil Court in Great Britain used to be a judicial committee of the House of Lords. The House of Lords is part of the legislature, the folk that make law. So how on earth could you have a court? And the independence of the judiciary is vital to any democracy. How on earth could you have an independent judiciary which was part of the legislature? The situation was constitutionally untenable. And fortunately, some government or other, God knows how many governments failed to see it, or to them it didn't matter. It's something I confess. My lecturer in constitutional law, all those many years ago, he was quite vocal in his condemnation of the Judicial Committee. And I confess I inherited that opposition. And I was delighted to see the Supreme Court taking over the function of the Judicial Committee. The Supreme Court is now totally independent of the legislature, which is, of course, as it should have been. I may say that the Act and Treaty of Union of 1707 did not confer jurisdiction in any Scottish matter upon a court seated in England. And over the years, the House of Lords bullied its way into determining Scottish matters as the court of last instance. Indeed, the story is told that very early in the... Sorry, am I? Oh, okay. Mustn't overshoot my time. Very early in the history of the Judicial Committee, a Scottish advocate was appearing before their English lordships, and he spoke of water. Well, water is the stuff that comes out of a tap. Everybody knows that. Everybody except an English judge. And then it occurred to him what he was speaking of. So he said very haughtily, "Mr. So-and-so, in England, there is only one tea in water." And I thought the reply was priceless. The reply was, "That will may be the case, your lordship, but in Scotland, there's twa ends in manors."
I now call upon the Dean of Law to thank our speaker for this evening.
So, Mr. Murray, I think apart from the fabulous content of your delivery this evening, I think there was an enormous amount of pleasure in the room just listening to you speak, the wonderful tones of Scotland that you bring with you. And I must say that my favourite part of this evening was when you said the word brave with the most amazing rolling R that I had heard in a long time. Do you think I could ask you to repeat that? I almost felt the purr in the room with that. So it was wonderful to hear, but of course not surprising to hear your story about how important Scottish culture has been to all parts of the world. And, I mean, it's obvious here in Adelaide with the names of the buildings and the tradition, and we have the pipers and many of the schools in Adelaide also carry on what I sometimes almost suspect is a more Scottish version of Scottish history than probably exists in modern Scotland today. And so it was wonderful to have that confirmed. And I think the other thing that was also very fascinating for us to hear about was the position, because I think we're all very interested in how Scotland feels about the whole Brexit position. So that was a fascinating insight for us here in Australia as well. And you should rest assured that no matter what happens south of Hadrian's Wall, that you have some warm friends here in Australia who are very happy to join with you in any kind of free trade agreement that you might like. So with that, it is my very pleasurable duty to thank you very warmly for making the long journey here, and we hope that you have had and have a pleasant stay in Adelaide, which you have told us is one of your favourite cities in the world. I must say that Glasgow is one of my favourite cities in the world. And for those of you who haven't been there, there is a train which I believe the locals affectionately call the Clockwork Orange, which sounds quite scary, but isn't. So I'm glad that you have found pleasure in Adelaide as well. So I have a multi-part gift, which I almost feel like is a prize here, and it has much of Adelaide history, in particular University of Adelaide history in here, but also a sample of our own fortified wine produced at our Waite campus. So it is a genuinely Adelaide gift for you. So if I could call upon everyone just to thank Mr. Murray one more time, I will hand over this gift.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That concludes the John Bray Oration for 2017. I'd like to thank you again for coming, and I hope to see you all at the next oration. Thank you.